Welcome to KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program, where we explore issues and organizations related to our community. Talk of the Rock is hosted by members of the KMXT News Team.
And good afternoon. I'm Maggie Wall, and you're listening to the May 28th edition of KMXT's Talk of the Rock program. May is Mental Health Month, and we have with us two mental health professionals, both of whom deal with the kids, you know, help the kids in the school, Susan Philo and Chris Foster. So we're going to start with Susan. Susan's going to introduce herself so you know which one she is. Go ahead, Susan. Tell us a little about yourself and what you do.
Hi, my name is Susan Philo, and I'm a licensed professional counselor. I've lived in the area for 9 years. I work as a psychotherapist at Providence Counseling Center, and I'm also the team lead for the school clinician program, which has been in existence for about 20 years.
And when we talk about clinicians, we're talking today, anyway, mental health specialist.
Yes, mental health counselor, therapist, there's many words, which is confusing, I know.
Okay, as opposed to some other clinician who might take our blood or do something else. So, okay, just to clarify. And then Chris.
Yeah, hi, my name's Chris Foster. I am a longtime Kodiak resident. I was a hairdresser my whole life, went back to school, got my master's degree, and now this is my second year as a school clinician. I was at elementary level last year, and when that got sort of taken away, I moved up to the middle school. So I work at the middle school with the kids there.
Got it. And you said something, I'm going to write an arrow here. The job apparently isn't there anymore, huh?
Right. There were two other mental health clinicians in the elementary level. So I shared East and North Star last year with another clinician. And then when our middle school counselor left, I moved up to the middle school when the elementary levels were taken out. They just strictly are using school counselors this year.
I see. Okay. So let's talk about mental health in the schools and how are we helping or not helping our kids. Susan, you were talking about some statistics. So let's just generally speaking, what's the deal with mental health in the schools?
Well, it's really progressive actually for Kodiak to have mental health clinicians in the schools. I think other schools have social workers, but we take it even a step further where we actually see, you know, we always get parent consent, and we work really closely with parents and families because that's the best treatment, best practice. But we actually see the kids and do brief solution-focused kinds of interventions with them. And in our case, our goal is actually to help them to succeed at school. You know, it's not as broad as if you went to see a mental health therapist who's looking at all spheres of life. But in this case, our focus is to help them to succeed at school. And of course, if they are competent and can succeed at school, then that's going to improve their mood and many, you know, if you feel competent and that you can get by in life, that's kind of like the number one resiliency factor.
And you used a phrase there in the beginning. What was it? What is it you teach them? Skills?
Yes, brief solution-focused interventions, which,
yeah,
which
that
means
one.
Teaching skills. It does mean it means teaching kids skills. So if they're wiggly and jumping out of their seat frequently, which is a common problem for kids, and some of that's just natural, you know, but sometimes it's over the top. And so just teaching them ways to kind of direct that energy in a way that they can stay seated and stay focused would be an example.
And then do we have bullying in the schools?
Yes, we definitely have that, boys and girls. And that's another thing that I deal with quite a bit is kind of friendship dramas as well as the bullying kinds of situations. So sometimes we'll do mediations between the students if both sides are willing to, you know, work on that and come up with strategies for whether they need to just stay away from each other or apology letters or whatever needs to happen with there. And along with that, anxiety is something we deal with a lot of kids, just teaching them how to We have a little outer office that Miss O'Brien, the school counselor, and I share, and we have a couch out there and a guitar and a bouncy ball they can sit on, so they might, you know, be able to come out there and just take a break if they're just feeling anxiety. And so really helping them with all those different kinds of emotions and feelings that sometimes are just overwhelming.
Friendship dramas in the junior high school, I bet there's a lot of friendship dramas.
Yes, there is.
And do you help them learn how to communicate better? Or, you know, I mean, how often do best friends get angry with each other and then the next day they're okay? How do you know if it's ongoing? Or I don't know, I guess I'm trying to understand.
Right. Well, definitely what we'll do is we'll sit down and give each of the students a turn to, you know, say where they feel the problem started, and the other one has to kind of, you know, what did they hear from the other side? You know, it may have started 2 years ago, and we may work out a solution where they've been sort of hating on each other for a long while over a misunderstanding, and then the friendship is restored. It happens quite a lot. Other times we realize kids just aren't going to get along, and so part of our strategy is to set down rules. You know, we don't talk to our friends about this person. We don't interact with this person. Whatever needs to happen. And then they have to agree and make a little contract. And then we come back in 2 to 4 weeks, depending on what we think is best. And we reevaluate. And if one of them has broken the contract, then we pull them in sooner and, you know, have to try something else. So we just, you know, because friendship dramas can just really elevate their anxieties and frustrations. It distracts from school. So it's really something we find is really important to address, because it's not just between the two girls. It's usually this faction against that faction. So we don't want other friends coming in and building on that and making it worse. And then it's this whole, you know, big thing, including a lot of kids. So we try to keep that under wraps.
Do the kids in the schools generally get how many kids do we have in our schools?
I think there's a middle school about 492 or 89, somewhere around in there. Yeah.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. It's, we have a lot of kids.
Well, I pull this out on a fairly often basis. My high school graduating class had 1,100 kids.
Wow.
I had some classes that had more than 100 kids in them. They were mostly lecture, and they were things that were deemed like history or psychology, things that they could lecture at you. So, yeah. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's not a lot, but okay.
It's all relative.
It's all relative. So middle school is how many grades?
Three. Sixth, seventh, and eighth. Yeah.
Sixth, seventh, and eighth. Okay. So do they all kind of get along?
Well, one thing really interesting about the sixth graders is they're coming from four different schools. Possibly St. Mary's or the Christian school as well, which would be six schools. So there's a lot of integrating that's going on at that time. And one thing for me I've found really helpful is having sixth grade lunch bunch groups, where I've had two boys groups and two girls groups one day a week. And so I've had kids get to know each kids from other schools, instead of just, you know, all the kids from East hanging out all the time or North Star or whatever. And so I think sixth grade is just a really big year for, you know, new classes and all the changes that come with that, but also all the new friendships and possibly, you know, adverse, you know, relationships as well. So I think it's a really good time to especially have like things like Lunch Bunch, where they get to know kids from other schools and help that integration process.
Got it. Okay, Susan, tell us about some of the, you have lots of pieces of paper here. I just love it when people bring pieces of paper. Pick out something and
share with
us. I need
some reminders because I can't keep all these statistics in my brain.
These are shocking statistics.
Well, they are shocking. I mean, one of the pieces of paper I have in front of me is the youth risk behavior survey that was taken at the high school last year. And, you know, we know that our kids are hurting, but we don't know how much until we start to read the results of these. For example, 31.2% of our kids felt sad or hopeless almost every day for at least 2 weeks in a row, so much so that they stopped doing what they usually like to do, and that would be in the last year. And then it goes on, you know, to talk about kids that thought about suicide and kids who actually had a plan for suicide and kids who actually made an attempt. And it's shocking. You know, I don't want to go down with all, but, and then of course it's really shocking the number of kids that experiment with many different kinds of drugs and even ones that we wouldn't even think of. So our kids are hurting, you know, and I am so glad that the borough, the Kodiak Island School District, that Larry Ledoux have commitment to having mental health clinicians in the school, because, you know, we can red flag a kid, see a kid's hurting, and get them the help they need. And something that's happening that's, again, that I'm very encouraged about is that the adoption of a trauma-informed approach in our schools, and that's happening all over our nation. And it's happening not just within the schools, but also in medical care, social work agencies are using a trauma-informed approach. Which means that you understand how trauma affects the brain and behaviors and physical and mental, emotional health and well-being. And this is based really on a long-term study that was done in 1980 by Kaiser Permanente. And 17,000 people were interviewed, and there was found that the highest correlation with getting a disease like cancer or heart disease, early death, the highest correlation was with adverse childhood experiences, trauma. So it's not just, you know, I'm going to have a crappy life because I had a difficult childhood. I'm going to die early of these diseases. And so it was very shocking, because we've kind of had kept the two spheres apart, mental health and physical health. But now we know they go hand in hand. It's kind of common sense, but it's nice that we kind of have come to that, you know, our mental state really affects our physical state. And so this study, you can't argue with. It's a longitudinal study, 17,000 people. And actually, most of the respondents were middle-aged, Caucasian, middle class. And it was alarming how many of them had these adverse childhood experiences. They found that they're common. You know, 28% of the participants reported physical abuse, and 21% reported sexual abuse. This is 17,000 people. So sadly, it's more common than we'd like to think. And how people, of course, it's not talked about. And we also know that many people suffer with a mental health illness and they're not treated, even though like anxiety disorder, it's estimated 1 in 5 Americans suffers from some sort of a mental health illness. And that can be what we call subclinical, whereas in it, you're struggling and suffering, but it's not enough that it's affecting your ability to function. You're getting by well enough, but that doesn't mean life still isn't a challenge for you. But anyway, so 1 in 5 Americans, it's estimated, and this is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, if anyone's interested, these statistics come from, 40 million anxiety, 16 million depression, but only a third of those people seek treatment. And what's sad for me is our profession doesn't do a very good job of making, you know, removing the barriers and making it more accessible to people. I mean, there's the stigma, you know, there's the financial, there's a like piles of paperwork you've got to fill out and you've got to spill your guts. I mean, you know, we don't easily sign up for that. So that makes me sad. But on the other hand, I'm excited to be in this business now, especially now, because it's based, our interventions are now more and more based on neuroscience, our training is, and we actually can help people. You know, we can help their brains to work better, literally. So it's kind of cool to be in the profession right now.
Right, because a lot of that stuff that people used to say was all just woo-woo stuff actually ends up being neurological. And I don't remember it ever being something, but my dad was always saying things like, you could do anything you want, and you know. But there was a period, I'm sure in my lifetime, when they thought brains were fixed. You can't do anything with them. They're stuck in this mode. Where now we learn that the brain is constantly growing and learning, rewriting synapses and doing all that stuff. So a lot of things that people thought was just corny, actually, if you look, there are still a lot of corny things. But if you look, there's a lot of good neuroscience founded on experiments and tested and double tested and things like that. So, yeah, that is a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned trauma. I think of trauma as in a car wreck. Susan, so when we talk about childhood trauma, what does that mean?
Well, trauma has been just described or defined in many, many different ways. You know, we all know, you know, if you've faced a life or death experience, that can be traumatic. That doesn't mean you're going to develop a disorder from it. It just means that you went through a traumatic experience. But childhood trauma is different, and we're calling it developmental trauma in our field now. And that really speaks to kids that Chris sees often that face daily challenges, like maybe mom or dad are checked out because of substance use, you know, so they're not available emotionally, they're not available to give them their attention needs, sometimes not even to give them, you know, just the basic necessities. So they're faced with those daily challenges. And so essentially they're kind of always on high alert. Or they're so overwhelmed, they shut down. So when we face a situation, and for kids not having an adult available, you know, to take care of them, that reads as traumatic. It's not like sudden. It's just kind of ongoing experience of, you know, I'm on, you know, the kids thinking I'm on my own, or there must be something wrong with me, they don't care about me, you know, they think these things, and that's traumatic, you know. And I think it's in this case the situation is so overwhelming the child's not able to cope.
And can I add to that? Yeah, really quick, just to say
sure.
that
and before you do, let me just reintroduce sure. you, so that if somebody's joined us, we have Susan Philo, who's a clinician at Providence, and she's the team lead for school district's clinician program, kind of the mental health counseling program. And now Chris Foster's getting ready to talk. She's the clinician at the middle school. Okay, go ahead, Chris.
One thing I was going to say about trauma is trauma really is anything that, you know, affects your daily ability to deal with your life. And it's very unique to each person. You could have two kids grow up in the same home, and one felt very traumatized by moving around a lot, as an example, and felt very disconnected, and the other one might be fine with it. So it's really not as much what happened to you as how you process it and how you deal with that. And having at least, you know, one person in your world that is a support really is one of the strongest factors that help kids be resilient in their life. So you can have literally, you know, two kids go through being molested, and depending on the amount of support they have and how they personally deal with all that helps decide how resilient they'll be in their adult life. So for me personally, I know if I have a student who's maybe going through health class where they're really getting into the section about drug abuse and alcohol abuse and things like that, melting down in the hall every day, it's like we can kind of be there to, you know, pull them in and just help them de-escalate a little bit and just let them kind of process their day, and just a lot of things like that that you wouldn't really be aware that would come up from just taking a health class about drug abuse, but it brings up their past trauma. So I love that we can be there to sort of help them, again, just get through their day and de-escalate a little bit and find some tools to help them overcome, you know, okay, if you need to leave health class today earlier, I'm able to talk with their teacher about, you know, if this student needs a break.
And this would be because they are in a home where drug use is causing has caused them problems.
Right, or they're out of that home and living with, you know, family or foster care or whatever their situation. A lot of kids being raised by grandparents and in foster care and things like that. So you don't really think that much about, oh, well, health class is just part of school. It's that, but if it's triggering all these things from your past, you know, why aren't my parents in my life? Why don't they love me? You know, just things like that. It just, it's really, I love that we can at least be there to help, you know, soften their world a little bit and help them, you know, have some resiliency a little bit day to day.
And I'm really glad that Chris brought up the fact, the temperament piece, because, and also, I mean, there's many other factors that, that go into resilience, but also the fact that, you know, we kind of think of the extreme end of the spectrum when we think of kids that have experienced trauma, but it could just be a Coast Guard child that's highly sensitive and that's just had one too many moves. You know, yeah. It's not, and actually, and many of the families look, you know, they look fine and they're doing, you know, well enough. Thank you very much. However, something happened, you know, and I see families all the time that are wonderful, you know, and frankly, most families are wonderful. It's just that something happened, you know, and we're not recovering. So it affects everyone is what I'm trying to say. And it can be something that we wouldn't even think, you know, would be that big of a deal.
Right, right. It's very individual. And depending on how old they were or what the situation was, yeah, I could see how that would work. Now, Chris, we were talking before we came on the air. And before we run out of time, I want you to tell me about the problems that are in the school that those of us who don't have kids really don't follow the schools, you know, that much. The kids in the school all know, but there are a lot of things the parents don't know. And there's a lot of things parents do know, but they don't talk about. So what are some of the things that the kids in the school are having to deal with?
We, Leslie Foy, the high school counselor, Providence counselor, and I recently put together a presentation, and we interviewed a bunch of kids about, you know, can you talk to your parents? If yes, why? If no, why? And so what we found from that, which I thought was very interesting, was a good majority of kids did say that they could talk to their parents, but they wish their parents would ask more questions. And they would like to have more connection with their parents. I see another big problem is definitely the electronics problem. And I truly wish that we could make parents take all the electronics away part of the evening. You know, they're not getting sleep and all that kind of stuff. But we also had a lady come talking about healthy boundaries and rape and assault and that kind of thing. Again, we got feedback from those kids, and a good portion of those kids were happy with what we talked about, said we should talk about it, even though it's a sensitive subject. But they added on to that that they wish there was more talk about self-harm and suicide. And that was fairly consistent. So kids are hurting, they are cutting, and they don't know how to deal with things in a healthy way. So it's really parents being very plugged in, more so than they think they should be. Kids want to push away, but they want to act like they want to push away, but they don't. I mean, the kids are telling me they want to talk.
Okay, I have a question. Somebody called in, and then I want to ask you, hopefully have time to tell me about cutting. Okay, how does a person get help when they are in crisis mode and you guys are busy?
The ER?
So, yes. So it's important when you call to get an appointment to tell them that you're in crisis. And this is the whole problem because, you know, most people will say, well, they may feel like they're in crisis, but is it so high that they would go to the emergency room? But it is the way we do it here, you know. So, but we also, I don't know about Canada, but I'm assuming they're the same. We will take people for just a crisis visit, and we have room set in our schedules for that.
So the person, though, has to notify you that they have a crisis.
Right, and people are reticent to do that, of course.
Right, know. And so if somebody called and said, gosh, I'm having a crisis, my son is in trouble, we're melting down here at home, what can I do? The crisis word would trigger scooting them in to the schedule.
Right, right.
Okay.
And because otherwise it's difficult because you need to leave room for a larger, you know, to do a full assessment. So So that's why we end up getting booked out, because we have a hard time finding those big blocks of time.
But you could maybe at least talk them down or give them some advice, or mm-hmm. say you really need to go to the emergency room because this is a very escalated crisis.
Correct.
Or a person could go to the emergency room. You could just walk in. I've been to the emergency room a couple of times for various things, not often. I go there a lot with a friend who has issues, health issues. And they're all very nice there at the hospital.
They are.
Yeah, definitely.
And they're used to that, too. They're comfortable right. with that. So
yes.
it's nothing to feel bad about.
And, you know, we see people in the ER as well as part of our job. So we can at least help, you know, refer them. We can give them some tools at least and a plan, a safety plan for leaving the hospital so that we know they're not alone. They have support, just that kind of thing, too.
So if you don't have health insurance, though, if you go to the hospital or you go to mental health, they don't turn you away.
Right.
No. And we also have payment plans. We have Providence does not turn anyone away for financial reasons. And we also have people that can help people sign up for insurance programs if they qualify, which many people do and don't realize. So we work with people.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So good. I hope that helped them get their answer. So then I was going to ask you 2 minutes. I got 2 minutes. Okay, Chris, talk fast. I want to know about cutting. What is cutting and why do people cut themselves? It's mostly girls, isn't it?
It is. I see more girls than boys by far. It's definitely just a maladaptive way of dealing with their stress or their feelings, or they're either overwhelmed or, like Susan said, they're shut down. They're not feeling anything. So they want to feel something. So they'll cut themselves to at least feel some pain and to feel something. And it's kind of a release that way. So it's definitely can become a very long-term problem. And I have a lot of kids that I work with all the time that are cutters. So again, it's safety plan. It's learning new ways to, you know, relieve their stress or start dealing with their feelings. So it's a process, definitely.
So is this kind of contagious?
I think it's very popular.
Popular, okay.
I don't know if that's the right word, but it's mm-hmm. definitely almost can be a little group thing, you know, as far as kids know each other that cut. They talk about it. They look up, you know, ways to stop cutting, but also ways that people cut. So it's also on the internet. So they're pretty informed about it.
Because we never had cutting or anything like that when I was a kid. I mean, I didn't even hear about it till like maybe last year or so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you've got a child who you think is doing that, what do you do? If your friend is cutting, what do you do?
Well, seek help, because, you know, that's definitely a cry for help. And it can, obviously, there's a risk, you know, that they could get infected. And of course, they're scarring their skin. But you know, the primary concern is their emotional, mental
right.
well-being. And so, yeah, there's help for that, and it's actually usually pretty easily treated.
Right. Sounds good. Thank you very much. I have with me Chris Foster and Susan Philo. Thank you very much. You're listening to KMXT's Talk of the Rock. I'm Maggie Wall.